I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a minute, today's Supreme Court decisions. But first, Edward Snowden is obviously in a talkative mood today, taking questions from anyone who can get through in an internet chat set up by Britain's Guardian newspaper. Questions like, what's your salary? Why did you go to Hong Kong? We'll link you at hereandnow.org. Meanwhile, reaction has been mixed to his latest leak. He revealed over the weekend that Britain's GCHQ agency hacked into diplomats' phones and emails at international conferences hosted by the UK. And then shared that information with the U.S. through the NSA. Of course, the same agency that Snowden revealed was collecting phone and internet data on Americans. That leak this weekend, of course, put pressure on President Obama and British Prime Minister David Cameron at today's international conference hosted by the U.K., the G8 summit in Northern Ireland. Siobhan Gorman of The Wall Street Journal starts us off today. Siobhan, senior Obama administration officials told NBC's Chuck Todd today that they are shocked to hear of the UK spying on diplomats at international conferences and then sharing that information with a U.S. agency. Your thoughts?
Well, I don't know that this is particularly shocking. I mean, Britain has its own rules about spying within its borders, and they're different from the United States. I think that in this particular case, NSA's receiving that information wouldn't really be all that surprising, given that they would want any type of intercept information that would glean information about the plans and intentions of world leaders. That's a fairly common intelligence practice.
Right. Much as it was not all that shocking in Casablanca when there was gambling. And Chuck Todd said that other officials are all saying everyone does this. We just saw the Chinese change hotels when they came to California to meet with President Obama.
Exactly. Yeah. I think they stayed at the Hyatt. They didn't want to stay where Obama was staying, even though it was probably a bit nicer there.
Yeah, because they thought they might be bugged. But switching then to the internet chat today, what more did we learn from Edward Snowden?
Well, as you mentioned, he did talk about his salary because that was a big subject of speculation, where he clarified that Booz Allen was not his top, the high point of his salary income.
Booz Allen, the company, the consulting company, yeah.
The consulting company, Booz Allen, which had pushed back on this notion that he had made $200,000. He said he was talking about the amount of money he had made at the height of his career thus far, which apparently was somewhere other than Booz Allen. I mean, he's talked a little bit about his concerns regarding programs, especially this PRISM program that has as its stated purpose targeting foreign communications. What he is raising questions about is the American communications that are all mixed up in those foreign communications that go through big companies like Google and Microsoft, saying that essentially the government isn't doing a great job of what they call minimizing or throwing away the American information that gets mixed up in there. He's saying that they aren't providing sufficient protections for American communications and, in fact, are actually hanging on to them for quite some time. Whether or not they actually look at them, they do have them in their possession.
Well, in fact, you talk about time. Was this the reference he made to the 5 years as opposed to we'd heard 3 years? Was that the government holding information or was that these social media companies?
My understanding is that the government is required to destroy the information after 5 years, but the issue that he raised was that you can actually obtain a waiver to hold on to it for longer than 5 years. That was one of his points that he was making.
Well, what else did he say about the high-tech companies? Because we know that since Friday, Facebook, Google, Microsoft, Apple have been describing some of the data they've turned over to the NSA. Several thousand of requests for records in the second half of last year alone. Apple said around 10,000 accounts or devices were cited in those requests. Facebook said it involved around 19,000 individual Facebook accounts. What is he saying about, you alluded to it a little bit, about what tech companies, how honest they're being about what they're doing?
Well, what he said was that they're sort of carefully parsing their terms, and he suggests that they're being somewhat disingenuous in their responses. But what's interesting is that the tech companies have been pushing the federal government to allow them to release this type of information, which they have generally not been allowed to release. And so far, they've only been allowed to release kind of aggregate information. So the 9,000 to 10,000 requests are actually from all government entities. So that could be your local city requests to the NSA. So it's a huge range. They don't actually know what proportion of those were actually requests from the NSA.
Well, square that number that we're hearing of requests with some things we heard over the weekend. The Senate Intelligence Committee said fewer than 300 phone records of Americans were reviewed. I mean, a request is one thing, but
these are different programs. So when the tech companies are talking about their experience, they're talking about the so-called PRISM program, which is supposed to be targeting foreign communications, but in this case, they would be foreign communications routed through these companies, Google or Facebook, et cetera. The 300 requests has to do with the telephone records program, which is an entirely separate program. I mean, they feed off of each other, but they're different data points that they're dealing with. And so the 300 was saying that in 2012, they say they only searched 300 American phone numbers in this vast database of millions of American millions of Americans' phone call records that they're holding on to.
And Siobhan, briefly, how weird is it that this accused leaker is having an online chat?
Well, the whole thing is kind of strange. I mean, most leaking situations that we've seen have been ones in which the leaker didn't particularly want to have a public persona. And so Mr. Snowden seems to be of a different sort of flavor of leaker. This is somebody who really wants to be associated with the information quite publicly and does seem to be doing things like putting together, you know, participating in a well-produced video, as we saw last weekend, or in this case, participating in an online chat. To some degree, it's sort of taunting the American intelligence agencies, saying, you know, here I am, you can't stop me. And, you know, but from another perspective, it does seem to be that he's also kind of trying to make the story about him, too.
That's Siobhan Gorman, intelligence reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Siobhan, thanks.
Thank you.
Well, we have been poised for Supreme Court decisions with the session ending in just a few weeks. Today, we didn't get any of the big three, cases involving gay marriage, immigration, and the Voter Rights Act. But today, the court did strike down an Arizona law that required people to prove U.S. citizenship before they could register to vote in federal elections. Emily Bazelon is legal affairs editor for Slate. She joins us from the studios of Yale University. Emily, first, this was a voter-approved 2004 law. Flesh out, what did it require?
It required people to provide proof of citizenship, their immigration papers, their birth certificate, their driver's license, if the license could actually tell whether they were a citizen or an immigrant.
Yeah, so this wasn't about, you know, the ID cards when you go to vote. This was registering. And a pretty strong 7-2 ruling against it. What was the court's reasoning?
There's a federal law that sets forth what people are supposed to provide when they register to vote. And it says that for non-citizens, you're supposed to swear that you've been naturalized. The federal law says that states have to accept and use this form. And so the Supreme Court said accept and use can't mean adding on this whole separate kind of requirement that Arizona did. And so the court, you're right, in a strong ruling, struck down Arizona's law.
Yeah. And three other states with almost identical laws had joined Arizona in arguments. You know, of course, those are struck down as well.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And, you know, the larger context here is we've seen a rash of voter ID laws in the states, and really most of them have been struck down either by state Supreme Court rulings or federal courts. And it's interesting to see that this particular kind of effort to tighten up voting has really not passed through the courts.
Does that surprise you? Because it's considered a conservative court.
It's somewhat surprising, but there's a very careful textual analysis here from Justice Scalia in which he says, look, the Constitution gives states the power to say the time, place, and manner of elections, but then it says that Congress can alter and make its own rules. And so basically Scalia's ruling of that dual way in which the Constitution apportions responsibility to the Congress and to the states is to say, you know what, Congress wins. And so because of that constitutional provision, that's what really drives this ruling here.
Let's see how many other rulings, decisions we can get in. Not the big three, but important to people. In another ruling, the court said a jury, not a judge, should make the call on facts that can trigger mandatory sentences. Now, this was a case, someone was convicted of armed robbery and firearm possession. Alan Alleyne, I think is the name. What does this mean?
Well, this is this string of cases the court has issued in the last several years saying that juries, not judges, have to find the facts that determine whether someone goes to prison and now how long they are sentenced for under a mandatory minimum. And so essentially what happened in this case was this guy, the jury said, okay, yes, he used the gun that he was convicted for, but they didn't find that the firearm was brandished. And if you had the brandishing, you had a 7-year mandatory minimum without about that. It was only 5 years. The judge said, I think there was enough for brandishing here. I'm going to give him at least 7. And the court said, no, the jury had to find that fact.
Oh, fascinating. In another decision, the Supreme Court ruled that prosecutors can use a suspect's silence against him if it comes before he's been read his Miranda rights. You know, always the debate is about can what you say be used before you are read your Miranda rights? But if you don't say anything, the question is, can that be used as well? What was the case and what was the ruling?
Well, this is a guy named Salinas, and he was being questioned by the police, and he started answering some questions about a murder. But then the cop said, well, do you think that if we tested your gun, we'd find that the shell casings used in this crime matched your gun? And he stopped talking. So then at trial, the prosecution used the fact that he had stopped talking against him. And he said, wait a second, I have a right under the Fifth Amendment not to incriminate myself. The court said, no, you know, you have to explicitly say I'm invoking my Fifth Amendment right. And since you just kept quiet, the prosecution can point that out to the jury.
Okay. Thank goodness it's you explaining these and not me, because I think we have room for one more. And this is a patent ruling. This is a case that involves deals between drug companies and their generic drug competitors. The court ruled today that these deals could be illegal in some cases because they violate antitrust law. They keep cheaper forms of drugs off the market. This is when drug companies make a deal with the generic competitors not to make the drugs. And the justices say the government can inspect what's called pay for delay arrangements. This is paying these companies to delay making the drugs. You say this is the one that's going to prove to be significant.
I think so. You did a great job explaining it.
Thank you.
What happened in this case, a company called Salve was making a generic version of a drug called Androgel. That's a drug that increases testosterone levels for men with low testosterone. So Salve went to the Food and Drug Administration, said, our drug doesn't infringe on the patent of the company that makes Androgel. It won in front of the FDA, but then Salve entered an agreement with the maker of Androgel not to sell its drug. Essentially, it's an anti-competitive agreement to keep the generic, which is lower cost, off the market. Salve got paid millions of dollars for just keeping its drug away from customers, and the court said that the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, can sue Salve to try to dismantle the agreement because it hurts competition.
Interesting. It seems as if the court, between this and its ruling last week on whether you can own gene research, the court seems to be saying get medication out to people, just in an overarching way. Emily Bazelon, legal affairs editor for Slate. Emily, thanks as always.
Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, NPR senior Washington editor Ron Elving for a look at what's going on in Congress and how it might affect Marco Rubio. Just kidding, but Marco Rubio does seem to be the man in the spotlight with immigration reform and many Republicans grumbling. One said flat out, he is dead to us. So what does that mean? Well, we know what it means, but more on what it means politically in 1 minute here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Find over 200 job openings at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back, and we're joined now by NPR's senior Washington editor, Ron Elving. Ron, welcome.
Hey, good to be with you, Robin.
We want to take a look at, first of all, some of the Supreme Court work that we were talking about today, but also look ahead at the week in Congress. So start with the court striking down Arizona's proof of citizen requirement to register to vote. How does this play out in Arizona, first of all?
First of all, we're going to hear from an awful lot of people who like it, who are immigrant rights advocates and voting rights advocates, and who are glad to see the federal preemption in terms of determining who is and isn't a citizen supported by the Supreme Court. And this was not a close call. It was 7-2. On the other hand, I think Governor Brewer and the Republican legislature will renew their efforts to restrict the possibility or to ensure the integrity, if you will, of the election, restrict the possibility that people are voting who are not citizens, who are somehow misinformed about whether or not they could vote or somehow trying to get around the law. They're very concerned about this. They're going to have another swing at it. And, of course, Justice Scalia has made it clear that he sees a way that Arizona might lawfully and constitutionally add some requirements to the federal form if they went about it in a different way. What they struck down today is only one approach.
So we may see this again. But it also circles beautifully into what Congress is considering on the issue of immigration reform. And by the way, I said that the Supreme Court was considering the three big cases, gay marriage, the Voter Rights Act, and I said immigration. I, of course, meant affirmative action. It's Congress that's really looking hard at immigration and the overhaul bill that the Senate is debating. You know, Senator Marco Rubio of Florida, along with other Republican members of this Gang of Eight, have been working on this border security amendment to the bill to satisfy the needs of Republicans who want to see more security. Tell us where we are in that debate.
Something is going to probably need to be added to the Gang of Eight's deal to make at least some attempt to satisfy those who feel there isn't enough border security. Now, this is an endless argument. Are enough people being caught? Are enough people being dissuaded from crossing the border illegally? And the big question is going to be, who will certify that the border is secure before the path to citizenship can be opened under this legislation? Will it be the administration? Will it be Congress? Will it be some other third party? And to what degree does this facilitate the path to citizenship actually being effective? And to what degree does it really push off the path to citizenship into the distant and theoretical future? And certainly the opponents of this legislation, people who don't like it, people who don't want to see a path to citizenship included in the immigration rewrite, those people are going to say, let's really make sure that border is 100% secure and not one single person is getting across it illegally before we allow the path to citizenship. Something in the middle is going to have to be added to this bill before it gets the overwhelming vote it would need in the Senate to influence the House to follow suit.
But will whatever it is be too late for Marco Rubio, well known as a potential presidential candidate? And in an opinion piece for Politico today, conservative talk radio host Steve Dace said Senator Rubio shouldn't even bother coming to Iowa in 2016. He's in Iowa. He writes, sure, if you ask state party officials and some other big names, they'll say all the politically correct things about Rubio's chances publicly to preserve the process. Plus, Iowans are nice. But privately, he writes, I've heard Rubio is dead to me from plenty of conservatives. And it's in large part because of this immigration reform.
Yes, and I believe that Marco Rubio, although he rose as a Tea Party champion, is also being looked at seriously nationally because he is a champion for outreach to the Hispanic vote. And that is not necessarily the cause of every conservative, particularly not in Iowa. So we could see Marco Rubio's candidacy suffer in Iowa. We could see him decide to skip Iowa entirely, as other candidates have done in the past. John McCain pretty much did. You can walk away from Iowa and say, that's not crucial to my nomination, and still win the nomination. You can do poorly there, as, say, George H.W. Bush did in 1988, and still come back and win the nomination. But there is a point here that Mr. Dace is making, which needs to be taken seriously, and that is that Marco Rubio is risking his Tea Party credentials and his hard-right credentials, his conservative credentials, by being a friend, by being a pivotal senator to this immigration rewrite.
Yeah. What's at stake? That's the Republican side. What's at stake for the Obama administration?
The Obama administration has few opportunities to pass a landmark piece of legislation in this term as good as the one they have right now with this immigration bill. They've got a lot of Republicans on it. They should be able to get something out. It'll be tough in the House, but they can get it done. And if so, this will be, in a sense, the twin landmark to Obamacare.
Yeah. And before we let you go, let's ask about the G8 summit. Putting this sort of get smart episode that's unfolding aside, you know, everybody apparently bugging everybody else. Syria, certainly at the top of the agenda, serious issue. The U.S. saying it's going to increase the size and scope of its assistance to the Syrian rebels, actually talking about small arms. What can we expect out of this meeting?
Not too much. Don't expect there to be much more than a statement, and that statement will probably be a little on the mushy side. The United States will certainly try in backroom negotiations to get more commitments from some of the other G8 countries, and particularly to try to get the Russians to back off on their very strong support for President Assad. That's really been what's propping him up.
Yeah, but how much does Turkey complicate the issue now that the prime minister there is more preoccupied with protesters, and this was going to be the ally?
It would have been a wonderful bridge if Turkey could have stepped up and done more. But because Erdogan is under so much pressure himself, he really can't be taking any greater risks on behalf of the United States or the G8.
Yeah. And by the way, I made a silly joke about all the spying. We're going to take a look at where we are in spying now with a fellow with a wig in Russia and a leaker here, you know, based in Hong Kong, leaking information about the U.S. But how much do you think this will be a topic of conversation at the G8?
It will be a topic of conversation, both officially and, again, in those quieter conversations that go on between the leaders. They're concerned about the revelation that there's been a lot of hacking and leaking and surveillance at previous G8 meetings, and they're concerned about what they're learning about the United States. But in the long run, I don't think these leaders are too naive. They do know how much of this has been going on for quite some time.
Ron Elving, NPR senior Washington editor, speaking to us from the NPR studios in D.C. Ron, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Quick heads up, it was a terrible weekend of deadly violence in Chicago. Our co-host Jeremy Hobson will have a story for you won't want to miss tomorrow. But we'll be back with the latest news in 1 minute, here and now. English is now a global language, so it's no surprise that some universities abroad are teaching English, are teaching classes in English. You can get a degree in mechanical engineering in English at a university in Shanghai. You can study economics at a university in Milan in English. Good for Italians hoping to improve their English and foreigners hoping to study in Italy. But now France's Minister for Higher Education is pushing schools to teach some classes in English, and not everyone is on board. The BBC's Emma Jane Kirby reports from Reims.
Reims is a city brimming with heritage. Almost all of France's kings were crowned here. But it's also a city that some might accuse of brimming with heretics, because it's home to Sciences Po, the Grande École, a competitive university, which teaches its students in English. Between themselves, Côme and Lila still speak French, but at university they've ditched their native tongue and follow all their lectures in English.
Staying in France speaking only French, I know that I would be very limited in my career, and I will have much fewer opportunities. The new world language is English, and we have to adapt to it.
I really wanted to become bilingual because I think it's really important for the world we're going to live in. When I compare my experience to the other students that study only in French, that it will be really easier for me to get job or internships abroad. I think it's really an advantage.
Well, I'm just reading some of the newspaper articles about this project, and as you can imagine, it's a pretty emotive subject. Some of the academics here writing in say it's sabotage, it's insulting the French language. One even says it's a cancerous project. But of course, this proposal goes so much deeper than just giving a few lessons in English. It touches, says Higher Education Minister Geneviève Fierrazou, on social mobility, employability and equality.
What we call in France Grandes Écoles, and I have been practicing it for years and years, without any member of the French Parliament talking about it. But it was against the law. In fact, it was illegal. So now, when I want to enlarge it for universities where usually students come from lower or middle classes rather than upper classes, well, everyone is scandalized. I'm a socialist. I'm for an equal access to knowledge and to an international culture for any students.
Well, I've now come to the French Parliament, the Assemblée Nationale in Paris, to find Conservative MP Jacques Millard, who, despite speaking several languages himself, is adamant that in France, it should be French that's spoken.
By teaching in other language as French, we are narrowing our influence, we are not defending our interests. And I think that English is going to decline in the coming years because Chinese is coming up, Spanish is coming up, Arabic is coming up, and even French with Africa is coming up.
So you should firmly handle the bottle of champagne.
The proposal is welcomed, however, by business leaders. Bruno Payard is the director of Payard Champagne.
It's a demand that is very common among the world of business, and one cannot say that this government is very business-friendly. We at Maison Bruno Payard, we export about 75% of the production of our Maison. So obviously, if you want to go and convince people to buy your champagne, you better talk their language, of course, in a business like ours.
You are welcome to invest in France.
The former president, Nicolas Sarkozy, was not really an English speaker, but he did have a head for business. Higher Education Minister Geneviève Fiarasso hopes her proposal would attract students from the Asian tiger economies.
We want to welcome more and more students coming, for instance, from Korea, from India. When we meet them abroad, they tell us, we love your country, your culture, your food, well, everything, but you're teaching only in French and it's too difficult for us.
The higher education minister has faced a backlash in her own socialist party over the proposal. But with youth unemployment soaring here, she says it's time for France to face the reality that speaking fluent English opens doors.
The BBC's Emma Jean Kirby reminds me of an interview I did with someone whose job it was in the French government to decide which English words could be spoken by the government. Times change. Back in 30 seconds, here and now. The federal budget cuts known as the sequester are kicking in, and they're impacting elderly cancer patients on Medicare. Now, Medicare D, as in dog, covers prescription drugs. It is exempt from the 2% across-the-board sequester cuts because the thinking was it would be impossible to get companies to lower the price of the drugs. But Part B, which covers drugs administered by doctors and other doctor care, is being cut, and that means clinics that serve elderly patients are now getting reimbursed less for cancer care. They're getting less money to administer that care. Dr. Jeffrey Versirka is CEO of North Shore Hematology Oncology Associates on Long Island. He says his clinic will have to stop serving a third of their elderly Medicare patients because of these cuts. So, doctor, tell us more about what is happening to you.
Well, when we look at all the drugs and take them individually, you'll see that there's a differential in some of them where, unfortunately, the Medicare payment now is actually less than what it costs us to buy the drug, never mind all the associated costs of the drug, including our nurses, our medical assistants, et cetera. So for those drugs, what we've had to do is actually write orders and have the patients then treated in a hospital instead of in our cancer centers.
And what's the difference there? Because we understand you may have to tell as many as 6,000 patients that you can't treat them in your clinic anymore, in which case they will go to the hospital. Why weren't they going to the hospital in the first place?
Well, there's a lot of reasons. All community cancer centers, they're near where these patients live. It doesn't require a whole day to come in and get treatment. There's not a wait. We want our patients to be treated where their physician is, and that's in the clinic. And then if you actually look at the ironic part of the whole matter is that the cost to shifting care to these hospitals is almost $7,000 per year per patient back to Medicare, as well as an increased cost in the terms of deductibles to the patient.
So it's more expensive?
It's more expensive for Medicare, it's more expensive for the patient, and it's not local to where they live.
Let's bring in 73-year-old Judy Wiener. She has been one of your patients. And Judy, do I understand your husband also has been treated by Dr. Versirka?
Yes, I've been treated for breast cancer for the last 4 years, and my husband has been treated for metastatic colon cancer for 2.5 years.
Well, we wish you the best with that, but what are your thoughts? I mean, are you going to be able to stay with Dr. Versirka?
From a patient perspective, I'm not leaving. But I would like to point out that the fears that my husband and I have associated with moving over to a hospital for chemo treatment are those associated with infection.
Ah.
There's a high rate of infection at hospitals.
My husband has had his own experience with that at a 33.3% rate of infection based on his hospital stays. And when you're immune suppressed from chemo treatment, infection can kill.
Judy, what else would you want us to know about the difference between the clinics and the hospitals?
First of all, the nurses are caring, comforting people who know their patient, who see them regularly. You know, from my perspective, it feels like a safe place. I can't say the same thing about hospitals, where I've had to be an advocate for my husband and watch everything that happens, remind nurses to flush a port. My husband even left a hospital with a port accessed, which is just a major no-no.
And I'm going to rush to say, I'm sure there are wonderful people in the hospital, but it sounds like you're saying in a clinic it's a specialty.
It's an absolute specialty.
Yeah. Dr. Vasirka, this must be a Solomon-like decision. How do you decide which patients you can't carry anymore?
You're right, and we have to look at each individual patient, their insurance plan, and the drug costs. We've been very fortunate most recently because, as you know, Congresswoman Renee Elmers from North Carolina has put a bill into the House that's supposed to stop the sequester cuts to cancer care.
Dr. Vasirka, this is relatively recent, the rise in clinics. We were stunned at how many Medicare patients actually go to clinics as opposed to hospitals for their care.
Yeah, actually, if you look across the country, the majority of patients who receive their chemotherapy treatment receive them in a community oncologist's office. Unfortunately, as time has gone on, you've seen a consolidation in cancer care. You're seeing more patients shift to hospital-based care. But for efficient, quality-based care, you can't beat a community cancer center, because that's what we focus on and that's what we've developed our practices on.
And by the way, about how much on average might your patients have to pay with an increase in out-of-pocket costs if they swing over to the hospital?
So the cost, as we said, to Medicare is almost $7,000 a year per patient, and the cost to a patient is about $700 extra per year per patient.
Yeah. And by the way, are you finding your patients having trouble getting into the hospitals? Are there enough beds in hospitals to take, 6,000 in your case, potentially?
In our community, no, there's not. What you'll also see is a lot of the community hospitals are faced with the same sequester cuts we are and are not interested in getting a high influx of patients. We're hoping that Congress is going to come to their senses when it comes to at least this issue. You know, we saw them fix the FAA so that we didn't have to deal with late flights. I find it somewhat ironic that late flights are more important than our nation's cancer care.
Well, meanwhile, a survey from the Community Oncology Alliance found about half of the clinics were sending Medicare patients away. About a quarter were laying off staff. 14% were in talks with hospitals about forming some sort of alliance. Are you also looking at that, some sort of administrative way to cover these cuts if, in fact, this bill that will close this loophole doesn't pass?
We've been a community-based cancer center for almost 45 years now, and in the short term, we're certainly not looking to change that, but certainly we want to always keep our eye open for the future.
Yeah. Judy, any thoughts for us as we go?
Well, I would just like to absolutely commend the care at Dr. Vasirka's office. The community cancer treatment centers serve a purpose that is unfilled in any other setting.
Well, Judy, we wish you and your husband the best.
Thank you.
And Dr. Vasirka will keep an eye on the bill that's now being considered.
Thanks very much.
That's Dr. Jeffrey Vasirka, CEO of North Shore Hematology Oncology Associates on Long Island, and one of his biggest fans, 73-year-old Judy Weiner.
Thanks, Judy.
Well, he has made an immense difference in our lives. And I think it is because of Dr. Vasirka that my husband is still here.
Okay. Again, we wish you both the best. Okay, we'll take a break. Coming up next, a song to start your week. Get ready to tell us what you think of it. NPR Music up next, Here and Now. It's Here and Now. NPR music writer and editor Stephen Thompson is back. His assignment again, bring us something to wake up our ears, and rumors are flying, Stephen. We're very excited. What have you got?
The song that I've got this week, it's the new single by Nico Case, a singer-songwriter with whom I know you are very familiar.
We love Nico Case. She lives in Vermont with pianos all over the place and was a great... Wait, don't tell me, guest. But let's hear and tell us more about this song.
I'm a man, that's what you raised me to be. I'm not an identity crisis, this was planned.
The song is called "Man," and it's sung from the sort of from the perspective of a man's man, and it's this very brash and smart and powerful statement on gender politics. You know, sung from a different perspective, and I love the way that it sounds so incredibly hard charging, and yet because it's Nico Case, who is this very nuanced singer, it has all these little touches of beauty. Her phrasing is amazing.
Talked to Nico many times, including in 2009, about her middle cyclone, her sixth CD. She used extreme weather events, mistreated predators, and pianos she got for free on Craigslist to write songs about love and life.
Yes, there are things that I'm still so afraid of, but my courage is roaring like the sound of the sun.
People, though, who aren't aware of Nico Case, tell us more.
Well, she's an absolute treasure. She started out singing a lot of sad torch songs, and she still does some of that, but over time she's expanded her sound and worked with bands like the New Pornographers. She's worked with Jacob Dylan. She's one of the great scene stealers in all of music. She's a go-to guest vocalist and just a great, salty, wonderful character, and just, like I said, an absolute treasure.
So the song "Man," you can hear now. But what about the rest of the CD?
Well, her seventh album comes out September 3rd. So we're gonna have to sit tight. But it's called "The Worse Things Get, The Harder I Fight, The Harder I Fight, The More I Love You." I just love her. I'm not sure I'm more excited about another record coming out this year.
Whoa, that's big. Okay, so you can also hear it at hereandnow.org, where we'll link you. And a shout out to listeners while you're there. What CD are you looking forward to hearing, something that's coming out? You can leave a comment at hereandnow.org, tweet us at hereandnowrobin, or tweet Stephen at I Dislike Stephen. It's a long story, right, Stephen?
Yes, and it's STEPHEN.
Okay.
And yes, dislike me.
Okay. Stephen Thompson, NPR music writer and editor, thanks as always.
Thank you.
On this final note, I can't believe Joan Parker, the widow of the mystery writer Robert Parker, died. Not because she was too young, although it's incredible to realize she was 80. With the help of the Harvard Stadium steps, which she walked daily, she looked a third her age and was always impeccably and impossibly cosmopolitan. Whether hanging from a trapeze for some fundraiser or pictured in the paper just a few weeks ago, chairing the Lifesaver Gala to benefit people with AIDS. No, her death last week is so shocking because she was so indomitable. I just saw her returning from a visit to the hospital. With a warning for children and apologies to anyone else with sensitive ears, here roughly was her side of the conversation. Yeah, the f***ing cancer. I have this f***ing cough, but thankfully they say it's not the f***ing cancer. Stage 4, you know. Would you like to come in for some lemonade? That combination of salt and sweet is the Joan Parker that Bob Parker fell in love with. He fashioned the foul-mouthed character Susan Silverman in his Spencer series after Joan. In 2011, she told us that was both blessing and curse.
The conflation between Susan Silverman and Joan. It's everything. It's annoying. It's heartwarming. It's sweet. It's sour sometimes. I still get letters from fans addressed to Joan Silverman or Susan Parker. And so to be so conflated with her, particularly where I was his first reader, he would write 5 or 10 pages a day. The first person to read those 10 pages was Joan. Now I'm reading them with an eye towards, is the plot consistent? I would say things like, I think there's a big hole here. 5 pages ago, you said this was happening, and now this isn't consistent with what's happening over here. That, or he wrote beautiful descriptive passages. Rain, particularly, was one of his favorite things to write about. And sometimes I would say, I'm missing the descriptive passages. And he would say, I'm just trying to get through this book. Like, no, don't rush it, because I can see when you're rushing. And then we would come to Susan Silverman. And I'd say, okay, here we go again. She is driving me crazy. She's so adulatory. So, oh, Spencer, you are the man with the code. And, of course, you right all wrongs. And you're the most outstanding, extraordinary of men, blah, blah, blah. And I'd say, for God's sake, can't she say, what the hell are you doing, Spencer? This makes no sense, or whatever. He said at one point, you do not get it. Susan Silverman is my idealized version of you. She doesn't confront me, so you might want to take a lesson. No, I do not want to take a lesson from Susan Silverman. I want it to be the other way around. And so we would go back and forth on the subject.
We were talking to Joan Parker because after Robert Parker died in 2010, Joan and her sons found writer Ace Atkins to continue Bob's literary legacy. Ace has released several new Spencer books. His latest, Wonderland, came out in May. Today we asked him for his thoughts about Joan Parker.
She would always give me notes. She'd say, you know, this doesn't sound quite right for Spencer. But it would always be never heavy-handed. It was always something that I had not thought about, and it was usually a big kind of broad idea about the tone of the book or something, and it was something that I always listened to, and it was something that always helped me out a great deal. But I always expected when I first met Joan that she would have a lot of similarities with her and Susan Silverman, but in fact what you learn with Joan is she's much better. There was always a part in the Spencer books, and Spencer would always talk about how when Susan Silverman would walk into a room, all heads would turn, and they'd want to know, who is that? And when I was reading those books before I met Joan Parker, I always thought that was something that Parker was fictionalizing. But then when you got to know Joan Parker and went to dinner with Joan Parker, you realized he was writing with just great realism. That's the way that Joan Parker was in real life.
Author Ace Atkins talking about Joan Parker, philanthropist and inspiration for her husband, the late Robert Parker. She died last Tuesday of lung cancer. It's going to be a lot more boring around here with her gone. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us to see what this week brings here and now.